sunny and in the 70s in Columbia, South Carolina today, but the worst of the flooding in that state is not over. Rivers swollen from days of pounding rains are now flowing downstream towards the Atlantic.
About 1,000 people were evacuated from outside Columbia today as crews scrambled to stabilize the Beaver Dam. In coastal Georgetown, residents are also concerned about new flooding on the Black and Waccamaw Rivers. And what happens when those waters recede? Everything from pipes to roads to bridges to dams has been hit. Andy Shane is with the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. And Andy, we've been seeing roads just collapsing, huge sinkholes. We know we don't know the full extent, but tick through some of the damage that we do know about.
Well, you know, at the moment, you know, we have 411 roads closed in South Carolina. 129 of them have been washed out. You know, almost a fourth of them have been in just one county, Richland County, where Columbia, the capital of South Carolina, is located. And we have 34 bridges and roads that have been washed out by a storm that drenched our area. Essentially, on Sunday, we got the same amount of rain on Sunday as we got in the previous 3 months combined.
Right.
So it's been really of biblical proportions. You know, we're still trying to figure out, you know, what's been damaged, how much has been damaged, and how we can fix it.
Well, and we're seeing, you know, maps of the area that show where all this damage is, and people are pointing out that's where people commute. I mean, this really is going to be a mess.
It is. It is. So far, the interstates are back operating. A lot of the major arteries are back. A lot of the areas that have been wiped out have been along creeks, and they're obviously roads that lead to a lot of neighborhoods. And so you're going to have some folks who are going to be trapped or are going to have to find other ways to get themselves to work. There is still some concern about rivers. We have three rivers that flow through here. And so there's still the potential of those swelling and, again, having some temporary bridge closures.
Yeah, we'll talk about dams. Your paper, The State, has a headline, Floods, Rain, Expose South Carolina's Flawed Dam Safety Program. Now, we know there's over 2,300 dams in the state. And only $200,000 spent on a dam safety program. What are the questions there?
Well, you know, again, it seems like that when we had the recession, and then there was some shifting of priorities, that apparently dams did not get as much attention as they should have. And certainly this will bring a lot of attention to dam inspections and dam safety. You know, right now we've had 11 dams that have failed in South Carolina, six of them here in Richland County, including the Beaver Dam that was actually intentionally breached to relieve pressure, but now looks like could become a full breach. And what the concern is it's holding back a pretty big pond, and it could end up cascading down to more populated areas of the city.
Well, and other dams breached, and they didn't have that, you know, partial breach that was intentional. And a lot of people woke up to floods around their homes. And no warning system. People are asking, wait a second, if a dam breaches, shouldn't there be a horn that...
You know, you would think at this point. But, you know, part of the issue is that this was a literally once in a thousand year rain that hit the state. Yeah. And, you know, what kind of preparations can you have for something of that, you know, of that rarity at this moment? But at the same time, there are a lot of questions about these dams because they're privately owned, privately run. And it's the responsibility of, say, the homeowners association to maintain it. So if there is an issue before that could have been triggered by this storm, could it have been avoided? And again, who's responsible for that?
That's such an interesting question you raise about the private ownership, because your paper points out that, you know, the home associations pass on their leadership, you know, over the years, and some of the current leaders don't even know that they are responsible for maintaining the dams.
That's correct. I mean, it's you know, like anything else with the homeowners association, I'm sure this happens across the country, is that, you know, the folks who originally handle it, you know, people don't understand what they're taking over, you know, one generation, two generations later.
Yeah.
You know, and some of these dams date back to the early 20th century.
Yeah. Well, yes, this was a remarkable rainfall, but a 2010 national report rated South Carolina 45th nationally in financial resources committed to dam safety. So there's probably going to be some attention paid there. And then you've got all the bridges and roads that need repair. Is anyone talking about a dollar number yet for all this repair?
No, no, not at all. You know, assessments just started really today. We've been declared a disaster area by President Obama. Right now, it's a limited number of counties in South Carolina, but that's expected to grow as assessments get underway this week.
Yeah. Tough time ahead and tough one currently in South Carolina. Andy Shane covering the flood there for the State newspaper. Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, all this week we've been talking about the impressive scientific accomplishments that have led to Nobel Prizes. Today we learned who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. Three scientists shared the award for their work in mapping and explaining how a cell repairs its DNA. Tomas Lindahl of the Francis Crick Institute in London, Paul Modrick of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute at Duke University, and Aziz Sanchar of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Joining us now is Rick Wood, a professor at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, who studies DNA and mutations and how they cause cancer. Rick Wood, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
Well, and explain what exactly these three won for. What did they do?
Well, this is fundamental research which has revealed mechanisms of how our DNA is repaired, our cellular recipe for all of our proteins.
So what did they do exactly?
Well, this is a fantastic example of how basic research has illuminated many aspects of nature, including human disease. And what they all did was to work with repair of DNA in bacteria, the simple E. coli bacteria that's found in our guts. Let me start with Tomas Lindahl just for a second, because he perhaps did the most fundamental work of all. He actually measured the decay of DNA. You know, DNA is a pretty stable molecule, but it does decay. It's unstable. And he realized that that decay is a natural occurrence. It's happening in all of us. And he measured the extent of it. And what he found was that oxygen and water are both DNA damaging agents. Okay? You can't get away from those. And so he measured the rates of decay. So, for example, in each of our human cells per day, he found that about 20,000 of the DNA bases, the individual units of coding in our DNA, are lost just from water reactions.
And why is that so important to know that?
Well, because when DNA is damaged or bases are lost, that interferes with your recipe for life. And if that's not repaired, if there's no way to fix that, then either a cell will die or, more dangerously, it will mutate. That will change its code and become a possibly dangerous cell. In humans, that's the sort of event that eventually gives rise to cancer.
But in fact, these scientists explained how the cells do repair their DNA.
They did. And the great insight that Lindahl, Modrich, and Sanchar all had was if there's a particular type of DNA damage that exists in DNA, cells likely have a way to repair it. And that insight really turned out to be true. And so, for example, Lindahl discovered the first mechanism of DNA repair to repair damage such as that caused by oxygen and water when bases are lost. Paul Modrich discovered how mistakes in DNA replication are fixed. And Sanchar discovered many aspects of how ultraviolet light-induced damage, UV radiation damage from the sun, is repaired.
So from a practical standpoint, will this lead to breakthroughs in how we fight certain diseases and cancers?
Well, there's no question. I mean, it's relevant to cancer, and it's also relevant to aging. I should say that one of the aspects of aging for all of us is that DNA damage gradually accumulates. But, a good example already comes from Modrich's work, which is that there are indeed humans who have a cancer-prone disorder. It's called hereditary non-polyposis cancer, but it's a type of colon cancer. And in those people, they have defective DNA repair, defective in the very mechanism that Modrich discovered in the bacteria E. coli. And that's affected treatment already, because what one can do now, and this is routinely done at MD Anderson Cancer Center and other places, is to look for a colon cancer at colon cancer patients and find out if they have this particular DNA repair defect. And if it does, it really influences the course of the disease and how treatment is undertaken.
I saw it pointed out in an article this morning about these wins that many of the prizes for chemistry in recent years have gone to kind of exotic discoveries and exotic research that Alfred Nobel never would have even imagined possible in the field of chemistry, this one being an exception to that. But is that your sense, that we are just getting really exotic in our research of chemistry these days?
Well, I think some of the prizes definitely have gone to exotic and complex types of chemistry. This is one where the exoticism comes from the fact that the chemistry is carried out by living organisms, and that's something Nobel probably did not envision.
In the context of your field of chemistry, how big of a breakthrough is this, what these three discovered?
Well, these are absolutely fundamental researchers in our field. They're giant. Each of them is a giant in the field of biology and DNA repair, and each of them has made such fundamental discoveries that they've influenced certainly our entire field and the entire field of cancer research.
What's the next big thing you'd like to discover?
Well, we're trying to understand, and the rest of the field is trying to understand, cases where DNA damage is not repaired, but still is tolerated. And cells have ways to do that. It's kind of a dangerous process, but it allows cells to survive. And when that happens, it can make some cells more cancer-prone than others, and some cells very susceptible to treatment. So what we'd really like to do is understand how we can use DNA repair capacity of individual cells in a way to enhance cancer treatment.
That's Rick Wood of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center speaking with us about today's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Rick Wood, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Robin, I love these Nobel Prize conversations.
Yes.
This week we're learning so much about science.
Right, and I'm at the point where I can receive it as opposed to a few years ago.
It's been a bumpy few months in the stock market, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 10% from its peak. We've also seen lackluster jobs reports in the U.S. and flat wages. So should we be worried about a recession? Joining us now is Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Diane, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And, you know, we've seen a little bit of a bounce back in the stock market recently, but it did go down before that quite significantly by some measures. What do you think? Is this just a dip, or are we in for maybe even a recession?
I don't think we're in for a recession, but I think the reality that even though China is only 1% of our exports, it's the second largest economy in the world, and the collateral damage of weakness in China is being felt, most notably in stock prices. Multinational companies, many of them rely on China for as much as 20 to 40% of their profits. So even though they're not exporting there, they're building and selling there. And when China's consumer wavers a bit, that affects them.
And has China done anything really important to fix the problems that caused all the trouble in the first place? Have they actually solved this, or they just put a Band-Aid on it?
There lies the rub. In fact, they haven't solved this, and their slowness and inability to coordinate reaction to what's been happening in China, sort of half measured interventions in their currency market, interventions in their stock market, and really some backstepping on fundamental reforms as vested interest. I call them the state-owned enterprises that made billions on China being an export nation. That backlash has really stopped the momentum of China changing fundamentally and shifting to a consumer-based economy. It still can get there, but the process and the transition is going to be very painful. And I think that's the reality we're now seeing. And it's not just in China. Remember, China was the largest buyer on the margin for much of the last decade and a half of everything from commodities to U.S. Treasury bonds. And when they slow down or reverse their purchases in those areas, we see an impact. 29 economies rely on China for more than 20% of their exports. Those economies now are not only slowing down, many of them are actually in recession.
So do you lay the blame on China for the weaker job growth in this country over the last few months? We saw only 142,000 jobs added in the U.S. in September, on average 167,000 in the last 3 months, which is the weakest 3 months we've seen in over 2 years.
Part of the problem is China and weakness abroad. There's no doubt about that. The stronger dollar, increased competition at home. We also built inventories very dramatically in the first half of the year. There are a combination of factors that led to that. A very weak first quarter. Remember, back in the first quarter, we had West Coast ports run strike. Inventories got built later in the year, and then we had to drain them down. And that exacerbated the insult of a strong dollar and weak growth abroad, faltering exports, to be honest with you, on manufacturing activity. So all those, it was a bit of a perfect storm to slow the economy down. That perfect storm, however, did not completely derail growth. It was a body blow. And I do think we're likely to have slower growth in employment going forward. The interesting issue for the Fed is that, you know, they're looking at an economy now that only needs to generate about 100,000 jobs a month to still be edging towards that full employment goal of theirs. And that's going to be very important as we move forward, is sort of the threshold is moving down on what it's going to take for the Fed to get to liftoff.
Well, I want to ask you about the Fed, because when I look at what's been happening in the stock market and what the Fed has been doing, it looks like the Fed and not China is what's driving things. That as soon as investors see that the Fed is going to wait longer to raise interest rates, which they were going to do this year, and now it looks like maybe it'll happen early next year, that's what really drives the market. And at some point, presumably, the Fed is going to have to raise interest rates.
we hope the Fed has to raise interest rates because that means the economy is actually stronger. I mean, remember what the Fed's goal here is, to lift the foot off the accelerator and acknowledge a stronger economy rather than hit the brakes. They're not trying to stomp out growth. And I think that's very important. The Fed did react and delay because of the uncertainty created by China. As economists, the Fed expected China to slow. I don't know that they expected the market reaction. It's not that the tail is wagging the dog here with the Federal Reserve, but the market revealed our vulnerability to China as well. And I think that sort of left the Fed very cautious. That doesn't mean that they won't lift interest rates. The Fed has also made a bit of its own bed of uncertainty by, instead of saying, this is what we're going to do going forward, they're saying, you know what, each meeting is live. Well, you'll know what we do when we do it. Well, that is adding insult to injury in terms of uncertainty going forward, because the market would like to know, okay, what are you guys exactly thinking? And frankly, we're not getting that exact answer right now.
And it's worth remembering that the Fed has two mandates. One of them is full employment as they can help with. And the other is to keep inflation at a certain target. And we should say at this point, at least for the first part of this year, inflation in this country is basically non-existent.
Actually, it's failed on that mandate on inflation for years now, and it's quite aware of that. Inflation has been low, average below the 2% target by the Federal Reserve for the entire recovery. If you average it out, only for a brief period in 2011 did they actually get above their target. And the bottom line is, if their target is 2%, we haven't seen it consistently since the onset of the recovery, and that is what their job was to do.
In your ideal world, what would Congress be doing right now on the fiscal side of things to try to juice the economy?
I don't think that world exists. Huh. You know, that's one of the greatest conundrums, is that the Fed has been burdened with too much of the burden of shouldering the responsibility for the U.S. economy. And everything from uncertainty in policy in Congress to uncertainty about whether or not we can even keep the government open through December. Will there be another showdown over the debt ceiling, let alone the long-term fiscal sustainability of where we're at in this country? Will we be able to pay our bills in a reasonable way? Will we set up long-term fiscal responsibility in a way that doesn't kill us all at once, you know, where we have to have a big cut or a big tax hike all at once? All of those things are being ignored by Congress right now. And that's one of the most frustrating things for the Federal Reserve as well, because the Federal Reserve is running out of ammunition. This whole process of what's going on at the Federal Reserve and what's happened since the crisis was predicated, when Ben Bernanke first laid it out in 2002, on a partnership between grown-ups in Congress and grown-ups at the Fed. Unfortunately, there are only grown-ups on one side of that aisle.
That's Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's check in on baseball. Tonight in Pittsburgh, the Pirates host the Chicago Cubs in the National League wildcard game. Lou Bluen is a reporter for the local program Allegheny Front at WESA in Pittsburgh. He sent us an audio postcard about Cubs-turned-Pirates fan Pete Schell at the park. Well, outside the park, Pete Schell is a ball hawk, one of the obsessed, might run you or your mother over fans who catches balls at major league parks.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to PNC Park. Tonight, your Pittsburgh Pirates host the Chicago Cubs.
Heading down, this is the river walk. Boats tie up here, you can see the river and all that kind of stuff. This is where I come down and shag home run balls. I grew up in Chicago, and so balls coming out of Wrigley Field, that's just in your blood. And so when I saw them designing the park and saw the layout, I said, okay, I'll be there. To me, it seemed natural. To most of the people that know me, they think I'm an absolute nut. For those fans that can't see, right behind us, what is that, 20 feet, is the Allegheny River. If you back up too much, you're going to fall into the river. Don't go back. I mean, every baseball player knows that, right? First step has to be back, or is it in? I never did very well with that. I think my favorite story, and I'm sorry for giving shout-outs, good friend of mine, Pastor Guy Wasco, he was a youth pastor here at our church on the north side. I stop in the office, guy's like, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going down the river. For what? I said, well, come on. He's a Cubs fan. He understands. So he grabs a glove and comes down with me. Well, he talks to everybody. He's not focused on the ball because I guess pastors focus more on people than they do on baseballs. I'm a hawk. I'm looking for balls, and I see the one coming out. So I'm taking the first step. He doesn't see that. I'm racing after it. The ball bounces as I'm reaching for the ball, and it's in my glove. I get smacked. The dude tackles me, knocks me down. I'm like rolling around, look, what just happened? And he's laughing and giggling and cackling, holding the ball. You looking for this? And I still can't believe it. To this day, can't believe that the youth pastor took me down for a baseball. The question is, how many baseballs have I gotten? And I really don't have a clue whatsoever. Maybe 300, 400 baseballs, something like that. I give mine away. I don't have a trophy room at home for baseballs. That's ridiculous. You'd have to be crazy to collect baseballs. I collect golf balls. I probably have about 1,500 logo golf balls at home. My wife thinks I have 50, so I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I don't collect the baseballs. The dream is to catch one on a fly, and obviously I age each year. I'm 50, almost 54, and I don't know how much longer I can chase balls down out here, because you only have about a second and a half. You know you're on when a bird flies and you've got two steps on it, right? Yeah, it's just, for me, it's fun. There's people set up chairs and stuff now, and look, they're barbecuing over there. That just gets in my way. To me, that's not what the River Walk's for. It's for catching baseballs during batting practice. You know, growing up in Chicago, you're a huge Cubs fan. I remember playing baseball in the backyard. Okay, Fergie Jenkins coming in to pitch. I could do Fergie's windup. I mean, I looked just like him. It was hard to leave that behind. But when we moved to Pittsburgh, we moved in like 1971 or 1972. This was a city of champions. Pirates had won a World Series in 71. They would win another one in 79. It's like, Cubs who? I mean, I'm sorry to all my family still in Chicago that's going to hate me for that. But it was very easy to be a Pirates fan at that time. If the Pirates aren't playing the Cubs, and if we're not competing against them for a playoff spot, I love to see the Cubs win. Yeah, I'm a Pirates fan. But I'm a baseball fan, I think, more than I'm a Pirates fan.
I love it. I love he says you have to be crazy to collect them, but standing outside catching them, no problem. That's our audio postcard of ball hawker Pete Schell. It was produced by Lou Bluin with the Allegheny Front at WESA in Pittsburgh. More than 30,000 UAW auto workers in the Midwest could be out on strike tomorrow. Members of the United Auto Workers Union set a midnight deadline tonight to hammer out an agreement in their contract dispute with Fiat Chrysler. A strike would be the first targeting a Detroit automaker in 8 years, and this dispute is being seen as an indication of how far the auto recovery has come. Let's understand with CNN's Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. And Maggie, first, you know, last week these union members rejected a contract that was drawn up by the leadership with Fiat Chrysler. So some analysts are saying that this strike threat is just to appease those union members while leaders try to carve out a new contract. Do you think it's real, the strike threat?
I think the strike threat is real. I think that they are trying to appease workers that were frankly more concerned about some of these issues than I think their leadership really understood, because there were wage increases mm-hmm. baked into this, and they were pretty good looking. The problem for the workers is they really care about two things. One is this two-tiered workforce. Those who are on the payrolls before the financial crisis are grandfathered in at higher pay rates than entry-level workers. Union workers really want to see that number capped and have the ability to move some of these members up to that higher level. And there's also an issue which is sort of coming to the surface now about work schedules, something known as an alternative work schedule, where employees work 4 10-hour shifts and they can be asked to change from late to early only within a few days. This essentially lets the companies run their assembly lines 20 hours a day without incurring overtime costs. Now, both the two-tier and the schedules were put into place back in 2009 when the industry was really on the brink and they were seen as a way to keep jobs here in the U.S. Now that these companies are thriving, their employers are saying, wait a minute, this is too difficult. It's not fair, especially the schedule is really hard on family life balance. You know, let's bring it up to par. We stuck with you in the good times. You need to do something for us now on these issues.
Okay, so it's some of those issues that they are angry about. This union yeah. represents more than 30,000 workers at 23 Fiat Chrysler factories in the Midwest. What might be the impact of a strike?
You know, it depends on what kind of strike it is. They could choose a targeted strike, which is what a lot of people are feeling like we might see if it gets to that, which will only affect certain key plants. And they could even last for, you know, a day or a few hours. If it's a nationwide strike, you're talking about much more significant implications. But you know what's interesting, Robin? Almost half of the Fiat Chrysler employees were hired after 2007. These are workers that have never experienced a strike before. And let's remember, it's costly for the company, but it also hurts the workers and the union, too. So I think that's why negotiators are going to stay at the table and really hope that they can find some compromise right down to the wire tonight.
And what do you mean when you say, you and others say, that this whole battle is being seen as an indication of how far the auto recovery has come?
Well, that's it. So the workers see this. They see the thriving sales and the profits, the fact these companies are back on their feet and say, listen, we got past a tough time. We were there for you. We want to share in these good times now. The auto companies have a very different view, and they say, listen, in order to stay competitive in this environment now, we have to have costs rationalized. And it's not just competitors in the auto industry like the Japanese who are not unionized who operate here, but also technology companies. There's rumors Apple may get in the game. Google may get in the game. They want all of their money to go to R&D. They don't want to have to go back to that really heavy, you know, cost associated with the old union contract. So very different view here coming from the workers and management.
Right. And the workers saying, hey, things are looking up. We want a piece
That's
of that
right.
pie. Right. CNN's Maggie Lake. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And of course, we'll keep an eye. Deadline tonight, UAW has set for a strike.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Joining us this week is Howard Duperly, a.k.a. Flaga, host of the Reggae Ride on WDNA Radio in Miami, and that's where he joins us from. Howard, good to have you back.
Jeremy, nice to be back.
And it's a good time of year, you know, especially in the Northeast. I know where you are, it's a nice, you know, 85 degrees all the time, but right now it's starting to get a little cool. It's a nice time to remember that indeed reggae music can transport us to the warmer climes. And let's start with some of the music that you brought us this week. This is Rocky Dawuni, a reggae singer actually from Ghana, and the song is called Island Girl.
From coast to coast, from Europe to America, life is such a lonely road. Island girl, the only one I want. Woman, you are the only one I need. Island girl, the only one I want. Woman, give me everything I need. Girl, you are notoriously shy. Let's take this step by step and never rush. The way you move me makes me feel strong. My heart keeps telling me so.
So, is there a big reggae scene in Ghana?
Actually, yes, there is throughout Africa, as a matter of fact. All of those countries have major artists who have been performing and producing reggae for decades, going back to, obviously, they were influenced by the greats Bob Marley, Peter Tosh.
Well, tell us about this one, Rocky Dawuni.
Well, Rocky Dawuni is just one of the prime examples of what reggae has done throughout the world. What you just heard, Island Girl, is not a typical selection from Rocky Dawuni. Normally, he's giving you a lot of roots rock reggae, but this one is so special. It's so scrumptious. The phones literally go off the hook whenever I play this.
Why? What is it about this one that you like so much?
It's just an infectious piece. I think also what it does is it kind of transports you back to the Caribbean. If you notice, there's a little ukulele in that piece.
Yeah.
Which not too unusual, because there's a lot of Hawaiian artists who incorporates the ukulele in reggae these days. But it's just a scrumptious piece. And I think what it does is it just basically brings back some of those fond memories that one might have when they go to the Caribbean.
All right, well, let's go to London now. Our next group is from London. It's a reggae band called The Duelers. This is called Rocking Back to Kingston. So what's the reggae scene in the UK like? I asked you about Ghana.
Outside of Jamaica, England is the biggest market for reggae. And this goes back to the 50s and 1960s. Just in case you didn't know, a lot of Jamaicans immigrated to England during that period. And back in those days, before reggae is what it is today, the beat at the time was known as ska.
Yeah.
And ska, by the way, is what we call jazz in Jamaica. It's Jamaican jazz. all the elements that you associate with a typical jazz composition is there in ska. The difference is the tempo. It's a 4-4 beat, and so the tempo is very fast. But this particular group is so interesting because they're led by this young man named Tiber Cranston, whose father was actually a merchant marine, and he stayed in Jamaica in the 60s, brought that sound back as a kid. He heard this music and started out busking, as they would say, playing on the streets, performing to what they are right now. You know, they've ridden the charts in England. And this particular album is called Back to Paradise. The piece you just heard is called Rockin' Back to Kingston. And it is excellent. Even avid ska critic would fall in love with this. And to think that they're not from Jamaica, they're from England, is just simply incredible.
But paying homage to Jamaica and paying homage Absolutely. To the center of reggae. Let's get to another one. This is a Jamaican reggae singer. Next, Dwayne Stevenson. And here is his song, Simply Beautiful.
You're only a wonder of my circumstance. And baby, you turn me on with just one dance. Lady, it would mean a lot if I knew your name. But I know that life will never be the same. Simply beautiful. After all that I've seen, there's been a million in my life, but you're the wonder of my dreams. Simply beautiful. After all that's been said, I hope the road that you would take ends beside me in this bed.
So what do we know about Dwayne Stevenson?
Well, Dwayne Stevenson is, believe it or not, something that's rare in reggae, or becoming rare in reggae these days. Reggae now has evolved into dancehall, which is what we would refer to as rap. But Dwayne Stevenson here is literally bucking the trend, so to speak, and is staying true to the traditional form of reggae. This is a ballad, and the voice here is almost angelic. As a matter of fact, some folks seem to think that he would make a great country singer.
Oh, that's interesting. Does that happen often, that reggae singers go into country?
Oh, it does. As a matter of fact, many Jamaicans are country music fans. You had guys like Johnny Cash, who used to live in the Montego Bay area. It's not unusual to walk into a Jamaican household and hear Willie Nelson or any other country icon. So that influence is there as well.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and this is also from Jamaica. This is Ja Cure with Rasta.
Passing through, hey, I and I keep it cool, yeah. We reggae music. I have a duty to create good music so it can reach the world across the seven seas. Yeah. Oh, it's the healing. No one can find this feeling here. Now the world should know.
I really like that one. Tell us more about Ja Cure.
Ja Cure is simply an iconic voice, very influential, also controversial. Unfortunately, a few years ago, was jailed for allegedly assaulting a young lady, and so he spent a lot of time in jail and produced from jail, believe it or not, some number one hits. And this particular piece, Rasta, is all about talking about the fact that he sees it as his duty to go out there and spread positive reggae music. and he's a favorite. He packs them in wherever he goes, and he's for real. He's definitely one of the greatest right now, and there's no signs of slowing down, and I think he'll be around for a long time.
Jacques Coeur, coming to us as one of many reggae artists from all over the world, thanks to our DJ this week, Howard Duperly, a.k.a. Flaga, who hosts the Reggae Ride on WDNA Radio in Miami. Howard, thank you so much.
Jeremy, my pleasure.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Have you noticed? Shrubs are hot. They're popping up in bars and health food stores. We're not, of course, talking about little bushes, but the drink. And here in our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been mixing some up. She joins us now. And Kathy, I'm sure there are some people who, I mean, there's just a craze, but maybe in some parts of the country not. So what are they?
They are fruit-based drinks with the addition of vinegar. And although they're new and although they're trendy, they are, of course, also quite old. They were used when there was precious little refrigeration or no refrigeration. Colonial America used to pile fruit into a crock and then add vinegar to preserve it. So the basis of this is quite old. The vinegar sounds extremely weird to a lot of people. They're like, wait, what? It's got vinegar in it? And I say, open thy mind and you will be pleased. These are very thirst-quenching. They are delicious, just with a touch of seltzer, as you're about to find out. Okay. And there are many uses for them.
Well, let's do the, I'm picking here the, is it shiso?
Yes, that is actually my favorite. So shiso is a Japanese basil. It's a beautiful purple maroon leaf, very fragrant. You can use regular basil because it's not that easy to find. I happen to have a garden full of it because it grows like a weed. So what I did was, here's how you make a shrub.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You take water and a little bit of sugar. It's not super sweet. Boil that up, and then you add any fruit you want. So in this case, I added the herb shiso, and then I added ripe plums. There's vinegar in there, and then there's seltzer.
You know what I'm reminded of immediately?
What?
Coloring Easter eggs.
How appetizing.
The vinegar.
Right, right.
But it's different. It was so different. It's vinegary, sweet, and fruity.
And very refreshing. Now, you could obviously take this a step further, and we might think of white tequila. We might think of white rum. You could add a fresh basil leaf on the side, a slice of cucumber, and you've got yourself a very sophisticated cocktail. What do you have next to it?
All right, this is the blueberry.
Blueberry red wine vinegar. So I took fresh Maine blueberries. You could use frozen blueberries. Same technique, water, sugar, and boil it down. I add the blueberries. So immediately when you add the fruit, this sugar water is infused with this gorgeous blue-black color.
And by the way, is that water and sugar concoction, is that to make a series of these or just one?
No, for each one. You can make a big batch of syrup and then make them up. And then you add the fruit, in this case, the blueberries.
Oh, this is good.
Isn't that nice? Yeah. So here's something you can do with this, right? You could boil that shrub. I added red wine vinegar. It's really fun to match the flavor of the vinegar with the fruit. You could boil that down and brush it onto a pie crust for an apple pie or a blueberry pie.
You were going to say brush your teeth with it.
But let me just tell you that a shrub, the name itself is derived from the Arabic word sharab, which means to drink. And it is this concentrated syrup, as I said, made from fruit, vinegar, and sugar. And it's traditionally drunk with water, but brandy, rum, tequila, anything you can think of, vodka, you can really play with it.
And also, I've noticed something else trendy, because these shrubs are made with vinegar. A lot of people have suddenly, here at work, apple cider vinegar bottles on their desks. I mean, apple cider vinegar is now being touted for all its health benefits.
Yes, it is. You will read about everything from it will help you lose weight, it will help diabetics, it's good for your gut. Some of these are true, some not so much. It won't hurt you. You don't want to be drinking tons of it. But the gold color one far side there.
The shrub here, yeah.
Yes, that is a caramelized apple and apple cider vinegar shrub. And I added just a touch of fresh thyme, the herb. That's my ode to fall. It's almost like a candied apple.
Wow.
Isn't that rich? And
yeah. It, but rich, I have to say, in such a light way. They're a little bit like the flavored seltzer water cans that you can get.
I think you can go even further to say this is anti-soda, satisfying, very few calories. And if some of those health benefits are true, it's a win-win.
Yeah. We also have a Concord wild grape balsamic.
Okay, that's my favorite. So wild grapes are very common all through the fall. So I picked wild grapes and I put them in there and I thought, oh, balsamic vinegar would be great. Yeah, give that a stir.
Yeah.
It looks like grape soda from here. Lots of ice cubes. I really like that one a lot.
Well, just as we let you go, what else? What else might you do with these?
So you can use them for savory cooking as well. For example, the Concord grape balsamic shrub. I cooked that down a bit. This is obviously before the ice and the water's added. I just cooked the syrup down, really cooked it down until it was thick enough to almost coat a spoon. And then I sauteed some scallops and threw a little bit of that in the pan and made this purple, sweet, sour sauce with the meaty, sweet scallops. It was fantastic. The caramelized apple shrub, you could add that if you're sauteing pork chops or grilling them, a little bit of that apple essence thrown into a pan to pair with pork would be fantastic. As the holidays are coming up, this is a very easy, quick way to make a gift and to use unusual ingredients in cocktails and mocktails throughout the season.
Shrubs with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have all her recipes, as always, at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks so much. I never thought I'd down vinegar that way, but there you go.
Right. It's pretty appealing. Try it.
Okay. And next, we'll throw back some soy sauce.